This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, I'm June Grosso. On this edition of Bloomberg Best for Monday, December 2nd, U.S. ISM manufacturing declines for a fourth straight month. We'll get reaction from Tom Priscilli, chief U.S. economist at RBC.
ISM below break-even does not necessarily portend a broad-based economic recession.
And Qualcomm's CEO discusses 5G and competition from China.
People are not concerned about is it going to happen, but it is. Can we make it go faster and can we make it happen in more markets?
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
President Trump is reimposing tariffs on steel and aluminum from Brazil and Argentina. The president tweeted that both countries have been presiding over a massive devaluation of their currencies, and that, he said, is not good for American farmers. And for the farmers' perspective, Bloomberg's David Westin spoke with Tom Halverson, CEO of CoBank.
Where is the U.S. farmer today?
I think it's quite a varied picture. I mean, we are in a much softer position for the agricultural sector than we were 5 or 6 years ago. You could make the case that we're probably past the worst and that net farm income will be higher this year than it was last year by a little bit. But the source of the cash flow is indicative of the softness, which is to say somewhere in the vicinity of 25% to a third of that net farm income in 2019 will come in from transfer payments in various forms from the government. And as I've said, speaking to you in the past, every farmer would much rather sell their product into an active and successful market to make a living rather than rely on transfer payments.
And one thing we read, there's a piece in the Bloomberg saying this, but I've read it elsewhere as well. When you look at some of the subsidies that are being done right now in connection with the U.S.-China trade strife, in fact, they tend to go disproportionately to the big guys. It doesn't trickle down for the most part to the smaller farmers.
I think part of the problem, as I've said before, is it's a rather blunt instrument. If you were selling into a market, that creates one set of results. Trying to sort of smear billions of dollars across a large sector of the economy and get to equitable results is a very complicated and difficult thing to do. The fact that larger producers get more is not dissimilar to the fact that larger producers get more in the marketplace as well. That's just the way that the marketplace is differentiated. It's not different in agriculture than it is in other sectors of the economy where the big people predominate in terms of volume. The smaller people, you know, are by definition smaller and get less of it.
Tom, as you say, it's not a monolith, the farming community. But if you can generalize, if you're a farmer in America and you're feeling it being pretty tight right now, what do you attribute that to? Who do you blame? What do you blame?
Well, that's a great question. And if you ask a bunch of farmers, you're going to get a quite varied and differentiated set of answers, depending on their geography, their political predispositions. You know, people vote on lots of issues. They don't just vote on, you know, their pocketbook, although some do. But their explanation of the pocketbook results that they're experiencing can be quite different. So you could ask one farmer and say, you know, the tariff story, who do you hold responsible? And they might say, well, the president. And you ask another farmer and they might say, the Chinese. You ask them, are you willing to wait as we duke it out in this trade war for a good result? And a lot of them will say, absolutely, I trust the president and they're doing the right thing and I will support them, even though in the short term that costs me a lot of money. Other people might have a different view. So I'm very reluctant to be drawn into, you know, portraying any portion of our customer base as monolithically of this view or that. It's really quite varied.
We're talking with Tom Halverson. He's the CEO of CoBank. When a farmer recognizes they're not a monolith, but when a farmer wakes up this morning and sees the president say, we're going to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum from Brazil and Argentina, and that's going to help the farmers, can they connect those dots? Because I'm going to say when I first read it, I wasn't sure how the one relates to the other.
On the one hand, I would say that farmers tend to be way above normal in the population in terms of understanding international trade because they are so dependent on it for their livelihood. They tend to pay attention to what's going on in overseas markets where their products get sold. But I think a lot of people would know and understand that the foreign exchange effects with Brazil and Argentina have more to do with the fact that those economies are suffering and underperforming, and their foreign currency position is more a function of that than it is their intention to do anything with respect to agricultural markets. The reality of the pain and suffering economically that U.S. farmers are secondarily experiencing at the hands of Brazil and Argentina is predominantly caused by the fact of the trade war, which means that the Chinese were not exporting products that we were, agricultural products that we were exporting to China before. That's created an opportunity for people like Brazil and Argentina to fill that market. And because their economies are not performing well and their foreign exchange rate is lower, that just gives them a further tailwind to take market share from us in agricultural commodities.
So as you suggest, the United States, is not exporting soybeans to China. Brazil is instead.
Correct.
They're stepping in. This has gone on longer than I think a lot of people, including the President of the United States, anticipated that it would. At what point do those trading relationships really get etched in so it's hard to reverse them once this is resolved?
Well, I think we are already well into the phase where you can't just flip a light switch and go back to the status quo ante before all of this began, right? You don't build market share or customer relationships for 25 years and then have this result go on for 2 or 3 years and then have them come right back.
That was Tom Halvorsen, CEO of CoBank. Coming up, Tom Porcelli, RBC Chief U.S. Economist. This is Bloomberg. From the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, this is Bloomberg Best. Manufacturing contracted for a fourth straight month against a backdrop of weaker orders and subdued production. To get some perspective on the data, Bloomberg's Guy Johnson and Vani Quinn spoke with Tom Porcelli, RBC Chief U.S. Economist.
Tom, a fourth time in this expansion that we've seen manufacturing contract. How serious is it?
It's not serious from a broader based economic perspective. In other words, ISM being below break even is not in and of itself telling us that, you know, the U.S. economy is about to succumb. The broad U.S. economy is about to succumb. But clearly there's pressure in the manufacturing space. And look, that's been true now for a number of months. But again, I would hasten to add, you know, if you look at ISM over time, right, historically speaking, ISM below break even does not necessarily portend a broad based economic recession. Right. We've seen countless head fakes, if you will, where ISM has been below break-even for a number of months and the U.S. economy continued to chug along. And I think that idea is particularly important today when you consider the sort of the state of the U.S. consumer. And the U.S. consumer is in impeccable shape by really any measure.
Now, new orders, prices paid, and employment, all of those metrics were weaker than anticipated, and really we're in the mid-40s, we could say, for this now. We're not sort of almost at 50 anymore, so we're quite deep into contraction. Is there anything we should read into those pieces of data?
No, again, it's all part of the same narrative, right? I mean, there's a narrative problem in the manufacturing space, and the narrative problem obviously stems from manufacturing, from trade, and all of the problems that we have seen in manufacturing have really been, that has been the catalyst, right? The catalyst has been trade and a really bad trade narrative. So, I would hasten to add, I think what we have to keep in mind is, even though we were moving in the right direction from a trade perspective, it is not a foregone conclusion that this is going to be a done deal, and I think. Until you actually can sign this deal, I think that manufacturer will remain under pressure.
Tom, everything happens at the margin. And I'm just wondering, at the moment, it looks like we are seeing signs of stabilization, as you say, at a very high level for the U.S. consumer. How kind of at that margin, what is it going to take to only just drag us down a little bit? And then what would be the effect if we do start to see the consumer rolling over from this very high level? I'm not talking about anything dramatic, but as I say, it's just those marginal little differences.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a fair way of thinking about it. But again, I think we need to understand a couple of things if you want to talk about the quote unquote rolling over of the consumer. The consumer balance sheet is utterly impeccable. The level of saving in the United States is incredibly elevated. The consumer is actually still on net. The consumer is still delevering. I mean, we're near 11 of an economic expansion. The consumer is still delevering. So yeah, I think it's fair to sort of wonder, you know, what does the consumer look like if they start to roll over. But I need the catalyst for what is going to force the consumer to roll over. And what we have seen is that manufacturing is not that answer. Manufacturing is 10% of output in the United States. it's too small to drag down the U.S. Consumer, broadly speaking. And again, let's be clear on what is sort of causing this problem in the manufacturing space. It's trade. Right, it's not a fundamental breakdown in any of the the pieces that sort of feed into trade. It's a narrative problem, and I think that's a really important point. I would also add, it's true. Obviously, manufacturing ISM has obviously been performing poorly, but the regional manufacturing reports, I think it's important to note, have actually been performing much better. We're getting very mixed signals from the manufacturing space. So I don't even think it's a foregone conclusion that manufacturing, broadly speaking, is in a recession when you consider what's happening from a regional perspective.
Tom, what are you expecting from payrolls Friday?
Yeah, look, we are definitely moving into an environment where payroll growth is going to slow down. We've obviously saw that this year. This year we're averaging about 175,000 jobs per month. That was roughly our expectation for the year. And as we roll into next year, we're also looking for further slowing. So next year we're actually looking for about 125 to 150,000 on average per month. So you're moving into a window where job growth is going to continue to slow down. But again, I would hasten to add, that's still well above break even, right? We pin break even for jobs at about 80,000. So at least over the course of the next year, this Friday's report notwithstanding, you're still going to be pretty comfortably above break even from a jobs perspective, which again is important in the context of the labor backdrop remains incredibly tight. That has been true now for a number of months. And as a result, wage pressures continue to build. So to us, that's not being heroic at all to continue to look for wage pressures.
Tom, in the context of the U.S., how should we interpret improving data out of China in terms of its manufacturing, also Germany as well? Does it have any impact on the U.S. and even the Federal Reserve?
No, but I think it does have an impact from a psyche perspective, right? I mean, I think one of the things that people were really latching onto was this idea that we were moving into this really sort of this slow growth. We're about to slip into a recession narrative, and I think manufacturing was really feeding that beast. I think you get some stabilization around the globe, which again is, as you rightly highlight, is what we're seeing. I think that sort of takes some of the edge off of that narrative.
That was Tom Porcelli, RBC chief U.S. economist. Coming up, Brookfield CEO Bruce Flatt. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on going cashless, why it's bad for tax cheats, privacy, and the poor, with Bloomberg's Srinivasan Sivabala.
The situation.
Indeed, the world is moving quite quickly towards a cashless environment. Countries like Sweden and Netherlands and Singapore are leading the charge because they're smaller countries and it's easier to conduct cashless experiments there. And people are also thinking cash is a bother.
The background.
The serious development started with the launch of the credit cards in 1950s. The Diners Club, 1951, everybody started thinking that it is now possible for us to actually pay without cash.
The argument.
If you look at it as a big data issue, companies like Google and Facebook are increasingly looking to take over segments of the economy where a lot of data is being generated. And this network is going to generate a lot of data.
For more on the end of cash or other quick takes, go to Bloomberg.com, or for terminal customers, go to NIQuick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
Broadcasting live from the Interactive Broker Studio in New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm June Grosso. Alternative asset manager Brookfield Asset Management is preparing for the next downturn, but CEO Bruce Flatt says we're not there yet. He spoke to Bloomberg's Amanda Lang.
We don't see anything in the current economic environment that troubles us that there's going to be something happen tomorrow morning. Having said that, we are close to 11 years into this economic cycle. I don't think economic cycles have been repealed. There will be a recession in the developed markets at some point in time. In fact, some countries are heading there today, particularly in Europe. And because of that, we have very high stock markets, and there will be disruption in credit markets, in stock markets. And our view is when you're in an environment that is more robust than otherwise you might otherwise have in an average environment, you should just be careful. So we have more dry powder in funds, more cash on our balance sheet. Our balance sheets are more financed long term, getting ready for the point where we can capitalize on situations if the markets turn. If they don't, we'll be fine. We'll just keep investing. But we're cautious. We're more cautious today than we were in 2009, mm-hmm. for example. In 2009, every dollar we possibly had, other than the ones we were keeping just in case the market went down a little more, every dollar we had, we knew if we invested, it would be fine. Because you knew you were buying at 50 cents on the dollar, which in hindsight clearly is the case. But there are some places in the world today that are like 2009 in the United States. Most people think of the prism we have in North America. For example, India. India has a financial crisis situation going on, which is similar to what happened in the United States in 2009. Probably not quite as bad, but the banks are not in great shape. The non-bank financials are in trouble. And what that means is that entrepreneurs don't have access to capital, and therefore they're selling assets. And we've been buying a number of things in India lately.
You talked about China, and that ultimately a third of your assets would be in China. And I wondered whether there's an update on that, just based on playing there in the context of the politics of human rights, of China's place in the world. Does any of that factor in, or is this a much more straight up, there's an opportunity and we have the capital and it has the scale?
Yeah, so first we said Asia, not China specifically, okay. Which includes India in our mind, but China to deal specifically with China. Look, again, going back to what we do as opposed to what others do, we go to a country, we move money in, we buy an asset, we redevelop it, we either own it or we sell it to somebody else. That really it's not strategic to anyone. Things don't move across borders other than just money. And it's not really relevant to anyone. And China has an enormous population that's building out and needs all the infrastructure that we can build and operate. So I do think it will continue to be very relevant to us longer term. I don't think I'd change the comment that I made years ago.
So you're just as happy to build a bridge for a dictator as a Democrat?
Look, we go to countries where there's 1.3 billion people, and we're helping those people out. It's amazing when you look at the people in China and what they're doing and how they're all becoming more successful and how they're getting moving into the economy of the world. And what I would say is, as we help those people move into the global economy, it's going to be better for everyone.
When you think about asset classes, is there one that you favor? Is it real estate, infrastructure, renewables? Is there a place that you're actually particularly keen on?
I'd say the success of our business has been we're highly diversified. We're in all these products. We've added credit recently. By having those, if many people are bidding up infrastructure in a certain country, we just don't participate.
That was Brookfield CEO Bruce Flatt. And coming up, Qualcomm CEO Steve Mollenkopf. This is Bloomberg.
With a Bloomberg Business of Sports report, I'm Michael Barr. A state appellate court upheld a Southern New Jersey school teacher's legal victory in an ongoing dispute over using a sick day during last year's Philadelphia Eagles Super Bowl victory parade. The panel upheld a state Public Employment Relations Commission decision that the teachers' union can challenge a decision to deny Robert Gurry sick leave. The judges found the football flu grievance can be decided by an arbitrator. Gurry said that he was battling the flu when he missed work on 3 days around the time of the parade, but did not go to the doctor. District workers were told that anyone absent due to illness on the parade date had to provide a doctor's note. It is unclear whether he went to the parade. The Swiss government says it will produce a 20-franc silver coin with tennis star Roger Federer's image on it. The government says it is the first time it has dedicated a commemorative coin to a living person. And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, this is Bloomberg Best. It's 47 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg Opinion. Bloomberg's Lisa Abramowitz and Paul Sweeney spoke with columnist Sarah Halzack about Cyber Monday.
Bloomberg Opinion. Informed perspectives and expert data-driven commentary on breaking news.
It is Cyber Monday. It was Black Friday. Let's get a sense of how this is playing out. Sarah covers all things retail. She joins us from the Washington, D.C. Bureau. So, Sarah, we've had a pretty good look at what happened on Black Friday. We're starting to get some data here on some of the cyber trends Monday. What are your takeaways?
Sure. So the latest data we have on Cyber Monday is it's off to a strong start as of 9 a.m., $473 million in online sales. And according to Adobe, that puts us on pace for it to achieve the projected $9.4 billion in sales for the day overall. So clearly the big spending hour is still yet to come, but a lot of momentum for the industry today. And that sort of tracks with what we saw over the holiday weekend overall, healthy online spending on Thanksgiving and Black Friday as well.
Sarah, this has been something everyone's been talking about. In other words, people are shifting to online shopping, and we did get a record amount of sales. But how out of the expectation is this? In other words, what's going to be the takeaway, the surprise from this shopping series season?
Yeah, one thing that I think is perhaps surprising is there's all this conversation about how Black Friday is dead, that these deals start, you know, as early as November 1st now. And so what's the incentive to get off the block and shop over this past weekend or even on Cyber Monday? And I think what's interesting is that online, Black Friday sales were up 19.6% Cyber Monday over last year. Cyber Monday sales are expected to be up 18.9%. That will make them two of the fastest growing days of online shopping of the whole holiday season. In other words, in the digital space, Black Friday and Cyber Monday aren't getting less important. They're actually getting more important. More of our spending is concentrating in these big deals events. So it's really critical for retailers to stay in stock today, to not have some website outages, make sure they have the merchandise that customers want.
How about for the Gen Z and the millennials? What are we learning about how they are shopping here, bricks and mortar versus e-commerce?
I think we all have this idea that Generation Z, you know, lives their life with their nose in their phones, and so probably they are going to prefer that channel to in-store shopping. That's not exactly what we see. In fact, when we looked at data heading into this long holiday weekend, it was Gen Z shoppers, the ones who are going to stores, were the ones who are most likely to say, "I'm going to be doing it with family and friends. I'm going to be doing it in a social, experiential way. I like getting out of the house. I like trying garments on before I buy them or testing out electronics in person." And so I think that there's not a lot of evidence out there to suggest that Gen Z is going to kill the physical store. They might just continue to, as other generations have, kind of change what we use the store for and how frequently we go to it.
Thanks to Bloomberg Opinion columnist Sarah Halzack. You can read more on this and other stories from Bloomberg Opinion at Bloomberg.com/opinion and on the terminal by typing OPIN Go. And now let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Ed Corey on KFVK in Sacramento. I'm reporting Amazon is fine-tuning its delivery network to make sure orders get to customers on time.
I'm Courtney Donahoe on KTRH in Houston. Nintendo's Switch console is poised for its best holiday shopping season yet, according to analysts.
I'm Elisa Parenti on WBBM in Chicago. I'm reporting Hostess Brands, the maker of Twinkies, Ho-Hos, and Ding Dongs, is getting into cookies, buying Vortman Bakery for about $320 million.
I'm Tom Busby, and on WBZ in Boston, I'll be reporting on Cyber Monday sales, forecast to reach nearly $9.5 billion, the most ever.
Thanks, Tom. The international race to 5G continues as tech companies work hard to be the first across the line. Bloomberg's Caroline Hyde spoke to Qualcomm CEO Steve Mollenkopf to discuss the impact of the groundbreaking technology.
For us, it's a big deal. I mean, if you look at it maybe in multiple phases, the first one is just our handset business will grow as a result of 5G, really in two waves kind of through next calendar year. We talked about that on our earnings call, and I think it's positively received, and that will build throughout the year. And then behind that, you really have a decade-long expansion into new markets as 5G goes into auto and goes into retail and all of these other, you know, industrial markets that people are so excited about. So it's a great story for us, a real story of opportunity, I think.
Do you think, given
that the optimism has already swelled post your earnings. We have your shares very close to record highs. People can certainly tangibly feel the excitement about 5G. Are you worried that there might be a letdown in previous cycles of upgrades or movement to new technology? It hasn't taken off quite as quickly as everyone has expected, and you end up having a little bit of the reality striking. How have you got any evidence for us that this is going to hit the ground running as quickly as you foresee?
Probably the best example, if you look at what we're working on, of course, we work with all the handset partners, and so we kind of have a good sense of what's coming over the next year. And I can tell you the arguments or the intensity is not on, please, is this going to happen? It's get this to happen faster. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that, you know, roll out. A lot of our engineering staff is focused on this. And so I can tell you people are not concerned about is it going to happen, but it is. Can we make it go faster, and can we make it happen in more markets? And that's a great thing. I think the handset, what it means to the handset, what it means to the operator, it's coming. And by this time next year, it's going to be difficult, I think, to buy a phone without 5G. It's certainly at the price points that most of your viewers would be buying them.
What will it mean for me as a consumer, first and foremost, in terms of using a phone? I'd just be able to access videos that much faster. But what is the seismic shift there?
Well, I would say it's less about seismic to the consumer, although the consumer will see significant benefits in terms of speed. They'll see the opportunity to get really unlimited data plans and things. But what you're seeing in the industry, if you go underneath, kind of from the operator's perspective, or from, let's say, the streaming video provider, is they want the ability to do this with unlimited data plans, or to really, really give the consumer the ability to watch things anywhere with tremendous amounts of capacity, because the data demands from the consumer of just they continue to go higher, and 5G is really required in order to meet those demands. So I think you're going to see a tremendous sort of continuation of the things that are already good about your phone. They get even better with 5G. And then, of course, you get the opportunity to go into new markets.
Let's talk about new markets in terms of the outside of just the consumer, outside of just the phone. You've got connected devices, autos, industrial IT. How big is this from an economic perspective? How seismic is it for their use in case?
Well, I would tell you, I think for us, it really, you create a expansion of our SAM is larger than it's ever been in the company's history. Kind of numbers that are so big, it doesn't matter talking about them. Just big expansion for our business. So, because what you're seeing is there are large industries, and I'll use automotive as the first one, that are just being disrupted by the roadmap of cellular. First, it was connect the car to the internet. Then it was the driving experience and the consumer experience is about having the cockpit connected to the internet. And then it was, wow, if the phone and the cockpit are connected to the internet, maybe we can have some form of autonomous driving or automated use of logistics. And that just plays right into Qualcomm's strength. And we've built a pretty sizable business and a design pipeline as a result. That's a huge market that we just add with almost no additional investment. And then you see the same thing in retail. You see the same thing in healthcare, education, all of these industrial industries where they're trying to automate the factory. All of the sort of underpinnings, kind of the plumbing of the industrial world, is really switching over to 5G. And it's a great opportunity for not only us, but a lot of companies that have cloud businesses, for example. Mm-hmm. They all want to figure out, hey, how do I connect all the things wirelessly? And of course, they're coming to Qualcomm to partner with us.
You've previously said that the pipeline for, say, the audio industry is $6.5 billion. Have you got numbers, tangible numbers, you can share with us that you're going to be giving the analysts?
We will. We're going to kind of try to break that down into how to think about that year over year. And it's already a sizable business for us, and it's going to grow very nicely. And it grows in a way that's accretive to our earnings. So it's a good story for us. It's a real story of leverage and being able to expand the earnings flow while still using the same technology, or at least similar technology, leverage technologies from the cellular space.
It's interesting that, of course, all of this happens while for the past 3 years you haven't been having analysts calls and, well, having analyst days to a certain degree, because there's been so much else that you've been potentially distracted by. But clearly you haven't lost focus in terms of driving the technology, the issues, for example, with Apple, the litigation issues. After all that tension's put to one side, how is your relationship with Apple?
I think it's good. I mean, it's really focused on the things that the two companies naturally do well together, which is work on products. When you get engineers talking to engineers, things work out pretty well. And that's where we are today.
That was Qualcomm CEO Steve Mollenkopf. And that's it for this edition of Bloomberg Best. You can see all of our best work at NIBest Go on the Bloomberg Terminal. Our show is produced by Caroline O'Brien. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.